This is, again, unique experience. It says, the termination bore fruit in the spring of 1939 by the publication of this volume.
I go turn it off.
Is Larry's control free?
You may want to look at that.
I know. The termination bore fruit in the spring of 1939 by the publication of this volume. The membership had then reached about 100 men and women. The fledgling society, which had been nameless, now began to be called Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of its own book.
What were they going to call it?
They had 100 men. The Way Out. Bill Wilson was humble and suggested the Bill W. Movement. The James Gang. 100 men was popular, but then a woman showed up, ruined everything.
And the James Gang was because they had been studying the book of James a lot. And this is a pretty cool cover. I liked a lot of the old stuff they did. It says, their pathway to a cure. If you notice, this bottle has got a guy trapped in the bottom of it here. It's a way out. I love some of the old stuff they did before they dialed it back.
And you hear all kinds of crazy, you know, stories about it. It says, the fledgling society, which had been nameless, now began to be called Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of its own book. In Akron, Ohio, they were called the Alcoholic Squad of the Oxford Group. But in New York, now you got to look at the two personalities that are really running this thing. Dr. Bob was a live and let live. He was a, man, don't preach this stuff, you know. Yeah, I mean, Bob was in the trenches. Bob worked with over 5,000 alcoholics, worked with them, didn't just talk to them, worked with them, worked steps with them, helped in 15 years. You can do the math on that. It's at least an alcoholic a day, sometimes two and three a day. But in New York, they were called the Nameless Bunch of Drunks. They were anonymous. They were professionals. These were, some of them were going back into industry, and they didn't want people knowing about this because, again, alcoholism was very misunderstood. Shoot, today it's still misunderstood. People think you're weak-willed and have low moral fiber. We're not weak-willed people, and Larry will share a story about that later. But there was a drunk, and he was a wet-brained drunk and a contributing editor to the New Yorker magazine. And he was just, you know, all he knew is that there were a bunch of anonymous alcoholics. That's all they were, anonymous alcoholics. And he would rock back and forth in the meeting, and anonymous alcoholics, anonymous alcoholics, anonymous alcoholics, anonymous, period.
What's he blabbering about over there?
They took the name, Anonymous Alcoholics, and they flipped it, Alcoholics Anonymous, and they took the period right in the middle of the page in this very covert cover. The circus jacket. You're not anonymous when you're walking around with this book. But,
and they made this book big. You've heard it called, referred to as a big book. This book is actually smaller than the original big book. My microphone's off. I'm sorry.
I'm old. You notice it's bigger than my third edition, but it was larger than this. And the reason being, they used, well, it was larger when you're looking at it like this, but it was thicker. And the reason it was thicker, they used the cheapest, heaviest stock paper they could get. Because Bill Wilson, being the forever salesman, thought if it was large and thick, it was valued, more people would buy it.
Yeah. And in 1939, when this book came out, tail end of the Depression, $3.50 is what they were selling this book for. That's the equivalent of over $25 today. And a lot of people, and early groups, they had maybe one group one book for the whole group. And then somebody would be entrusted to keep the book and then show up at the meeting and read from the book.
There was another experience that happened during this time. They were going to vote on three things at this first group conscience meeting. Y'all ever been to a group conscience? Aren't they fun? Please. What kind of coffee are we having next week? Oh, I can't imagine what that would be like out here. For God's sake, if you said Folgers. My God. You guys are the damnedest. And I love coffee. I love that part of this country. Anyway, they were going to have hospitals. Keep in mind, they didn't have two nickels to rub together.
But this is going to be a big hit.
They're going to have hospitals. where they're going to treat alcoholics. And then they're going to have these paid missionaries, counselors, to work with alcoholics.
Compensated 12-step work.
And then they were going to print this book. Well, the hospitals got shot down.
Come on.
Missionaries got shot down.
Hell no.
And then in the vote to transmit the information via a book passed by how many votes?
Two votes.
You know why they print books, right? To transmit the information from one human mind to another. Mm. That's why it's here. Because if they hadn't printed their unique experience in here, you see, I'd be sitting with Chaz and say, man, you're not going to believe this. I was in the south side of Atlanta 2 weeks ago, and I heard about this thing, 12 little things, and if you do them this way and that way. Well, see, by the time it gets back to Eugene, he's got sheep and ceiling fans involved in the thing. You see what I'm saying? Well, I know you, Chaz.
Yeah. More importantly, this book was not designed just to transmit information. You know, the joke goes something like this. The sponsee calls a sponsor and says, listen, I read the book and I'm not getting anything out of this. He says, well, go grab yourself a cookbook. So he grabs a cookbook. He goes, find the chocolate cake recipe, your favorite. Read it to me. So he reads it to him. Read it again. He reads it to him again. One more time. Cool. Cut me a slice. I'll be right over. Well, I can't cut you a slice of cake. All I did was read it. Man, the book is designed to transmit an experience. It's a set of principles, spiritual in nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, will enable us to recover. That's the whole purpose of the book. That's one of the many purposes that Bill Wilson alludes to. But the whole purpose is to transmit an experience, not just information. There's a guy in Atlanta named Bucky. He sits on the front porch of the 8111 Clubhouse. He knows this book better than I do.
I saw him drunk at Applebee's.
I know. He recites how it works from memory, not the stuff we read in the meeting. He reads stuff like, being convinced for step three. You know, I mean, he's like right there, and he knows it. But he doesn't do it. And knowing this information is great, but unless you do this and practice this, you don't get the goodies that the first 100 got. So it says, the flying blind period ended. AA entered a new phase of its pioneering time. Also, we were still the alcoholic squad of the Oxford group, and we were the nameless bunch of drunks until Clarence Snyder, homebrewmeister in Cleveland, started and had the quote-unquote first AA meeting. And at the international conference in 1950, he shows up, got that tie looking all good.
Had his notes for the acceptance speech.
Because he was one of the founders, right? No.
He died with the resentment at Bill because he didn't get called to the podium.
Man. It says, with the appearance of the new book, a great deal began to happen. Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick, the noted clergyman, reviewed it with approval.
In the fall of 1939, Fulton Orsler, then editor of Liberty Magazine, printed a piece on his magazine called Alcoholics and God.
Now, this guy up here, Harry Emerson Fosdick, he had a radio show. And a lot of people listened to his radio show. And when he reviewed it with approval, man, free advertising. Bill Wilson loved that. You know, he was cagey and he wanted to try to get as many people as possible to hear this book.
And then they print this article. This is the first widespread piece. Down at the bottom, you see that little banner? It says Alcoholics and God by Morris Markey. Liberty Magazine was like Time. So people read it and they went, wow, there must be something to this. Because see, there was a little undercurrent buzz about this secret handshake society that was going on. And all of a sudden it gets a little public approval.
Says, this brought a rush of 800 frantic inquiries into the little New York office, which meanwhile had been established. Bill Wilson and his partner, a guy named Hank Parkhurst, had an actual business they started called Honest Dealers, and they sold oil and car polish and all kinds of different stuff. But they actually moved into New York and Manhattan, and they opened at the 24th Street Clubhouse, and it was this little rickety back alley building, and on the second floor of this building, they set up an office, and Lois and Bill moved into the bedroom in the back, and that's where they had it. And they had this lady who was
Ruth Hawk, non-alcoholic.
She was the first secretary for AA. She didn't get paid. She got stock in Works Publishing. and promises from Bill and Hank that she would one day be compensated. But it says each inquiry was painstakingly answered. Up until the 70s, if you wrote Alcoholics Anonymous, you got a handwritten letter back. You went to I've seen some letters from the late 60s, early 70s, and they were handwritten letters. They weren't this, thank you for contacting Alcoholics Anonymous. Your issue is very important to us. Here is a patent answer. Each painstakingly, Bill, Ruth Hawk, the early members, they were writing these letters back. It was written 12-step work, helping people solve problems in their home groups or be able to find ways and solutions to meet or connect with another member of the early fellowship.
And as Bill wrote the manuscript, hand wrote it, she would type it.
Pamphlets and books were sent out. Businessmen traveling out of existing groups were referred to these prospective newcomers. In the early days, you would write a letter to New York, and you're in Omaha. And they'd be like, Hank, do you know anybody who's going to be traveling to Nebraska? He goes, hold on. And he'd ring up a buddy of his down in New Jersey and be like, you know anybody traveling? Yeah, we got a guy. He's going to be going to Chicago, and then he's stopping in Omaha. So they sent him back a letter saying, listen, hold on for about 10 days. You can call central office in most big cities and get a 12-step referral, or somebody will come and call you. You'll call and they'll connect you. Or you can show up in a meeting and hopefully be connected.
It was painfully slow in the early days. And we're going to watch how this thing... Keep in mind, we're going to dial back to where this all began in 1939. And it went to 800 inquiries in members by the influx of this... Liberty Magazine article. Yeah. And then what happened?
It says, new groups started up, and it was found to the astonishment of everyone that AA's message could be transmitted in the mail as well as by word of mouth. By the end of 1939, it was estimated 800 alcoholics were on their way to recovery.
That's pretty quick. Pretty quick, considering there's no email, there's none of this stuff going on. And then we're going to go up to the spring of 1940.
J.D. Rockefeller Jr. gave a dinner for many of his friends to which he invited AA members to tell their stories.
Well, what really happened here is Bill and Bob their houses were being foreclosed on. They were dog broke. And they had heard that Rockefeller had
Foundation.
Foundation. I'm tired. He had a foundation, and they might be able to get a little money out of him. So they went to see his gatekeeper, a guy by the name of Frank Amos. And Frank says, I might be able to hook you up. Mm. Well, Rockefeller holds this party for these drunks, and Bill Wilson is the one that spoke, actually.
And John didn't even show up. His son Nelson went. It was a big deal. I mean, Rockefeller family is a lot like... of the other big... Yeah, I mean, if Trump hangs out with a bunch of crackheads, you get it's going to make the front page news.
So they...
Rockefeller dines with sots, and it was weird. They set up these individual tables, and at each table were a bunch of Rockefeller's friends and one of us. And during dinner, one of us would tell our story, and then Bill did the granddaddy story, the bedtime story.
At the podium. But the thing is Bill put the clothes on Rockefeller at the end of this deal, and... Through God's grace, Rockefeller said, sorry, dude, don't think it's a good idea. And he gave them a small stipend of $5,000 that they could draw on Bill and Bob. Because if he had given them money, it would have screwed it all up. And that was his theory.
It says, inquiries poured in again, and many people went to the bookstores to get the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. By March 1941, membership shot up to 2,000.
See how this thing has grown? It's mushroomed by over twice now in less than 2 years.
All right. Then Jack Alexander wrote a feature article in the Saturday Evening Post and placed such a compelling picture of AA before the general public that Alcoholics in Need of Help really deluged us.
All right. Jack Alexander's a guy that's kind of like Mike Wallace. And the publisher of Saturday Evening Post, which was the grandpa of the magazines at the time, said, Jack, there's a cult going on, and I need you to go check these people out. There's a lot of rumbling going on about this Alcoholics Anonymous. Go out there and expose them. So he did. He went to New York. He went to Akron. And what happened, instead of him being able to bust us out, we took him into our homes. We cooked him dinner. We took him to our meetings, and we let him hear the honest sharing from our hearts, one heart to another. And during that experience, he was blown away. And it says that he plays such a compelling picture before the public that by the close of 31, the number AA numbered 8,000 members. It mm-hmm. quadrupled. Mm-hmm. And this deal right here, I mean, you can go into an A&A meeting and pick up a pamphlet with that article. Mm-hmm. Read it.
And Bill Wilson, it was a quote that was attributed to Bill. I have yet to be able to find it, but the mythology is that Bill said that he couldn't have written a better article himself.
What an order.
You know, I mean, because it's a great article. I mean, it's really a cheerleading article for Alcoholics Anonymous.
And then it says the mushrooming process was in full swing. AA had become a national institution. That's huge.
So now we're growing up. It says our society then entered a fearsome and exciting adolescent period. The key word in there is adolescent. The test that it faced was this. Could these large numbers of erstwhile erratic alcoholics successfully meet and work together?
Absolutely not.
Would there be quarrels over membership?
Yep.
Leadership?
Yep.
Money?
Mm-hmm.
Strivings for power?
Yep.
Prestige?
Mm-hmm.
Would there be schisms which would split AA apart?
Yep.
All right. Soon AA was beset by these very problems on every side and in every group. But out of this frightening and at first disrupting experience, the convictions grew that AA had to hang together or die separately. We had to unify our fellowship or pass off the scene. There's a place in Katona, New York. We commonly refer to Ardmore Avenue in Akron, Ohio, as being the birthplace of Alcoholics Anonymous. Really was. 182 Clinton Street, where Bill and Lois lived before they were dispossessed. You know, the 24th Street Clubhouse in New York, where a lot of the Big Book was written. Those great places. There's also Stepping Stones up in Katona, New York. And there's this little outbuilding on the backside called Wits End. And that's where Bill's desk is. And I had to get the privilege of looking through the window at it. I didn't get on the tour. It was cheap, I guess. But I was looking through the window at it, and I could see all the little cigarette burns. And I could see where Bill Wilson penned the 12 and 12. And a lot of other literature was right there at that desk. And the girl I was dating at the time was a member of NA. She couldn't appreciate what the hell I was looking at. So I kept going, man, look at that. And she lost on her, but I'm just like, this is holy ground. This was very sacred ground. Bill Wilson took over 700 letters that he had received, and some of them were as trivial as that damn group over in Little Rock isn't doing it right, and that little group over across the state line in Mississippi ain't doing it right. You know, and two groups against each other, both writing letters to Bill. He's taking these experiences, these letters, all these different experiences from groups, and he's culling them all together. He's finding out that we are really going to destroy ourselves.
We just heard that last week in Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. This little old lady that had about 10 years, she was part of the intergroup structure there. She came over to meet a gossip and told me about this group that met around the corner and how they were doing it all wrong and had been doing it for years, but they were still going strong. And I'm going, what's wrong with this picture?
But it says we had to unify our fellowship. Somebody had sent from North Carolina, sent Bill a little story about a group called the Washingtonians, who in the late 1860s had started a movement. Actually, I'm sorry, in the 1840s had started a movement. And their movement was powerful. It was a temperance movement. Their size at that time relative to the population of the world was bigger than AA is now. And the Washingtonians was really nothing more than one alcoholic helping another. It really didn't have a program of action. Really didn't have anything other than fellowshipping and helping each other not drink.
Temperance.
But they were so motivated, they got a young up-and-coming lawyer from Illinois, Abraham Lincoln, who was, prior to his career as president, they brought him to speak at one of their rallies because they were all about promotion. And they're all about not drinking until they were also not about slavery. And then they were, and then about religion, and then about politics. And then, wow. And then by the time the end of the Civil War, Washingtonian what?
They were
Nobody
gone.
Had ever heard of them.
They were bigger in numbers in their day than we are today as AA.
Yeah.
And we hear about singleness of purpose. We're here about combating alcoholism.
Right. You know, and people talk about the most important thing or person in a meeting. Well, the person is the new guy. But the most important thing is us unified. Because if they go across the way and they find that Frank's got a different way of doing it, and they go over here and Bob's got another way of doing it, and over here, man, you just listen. You're showing up. You rush into taking the steps. Man, they're going to shop an answer, and they're going to get different answers. Hopefully we can be unified as a fellowship so we continue to do what? Like our different literature says, sobriety, freedom from alcohol through the practice and teachings of 12 steps. But you'll go into some meetings, and after they read how it works, you don't hear anything else about alcoholism. And it's a free-for-all. So the book says, as we discovered the principles by which the individual alcoholic could live, so we had to evolve principles by which the AA groups and AA as a whole could survive and function effectively.
Principles, or rules of action or conduct. Rules of action or conduct.
It was thought that no alcoholic man or woman could be excluded from our society.
Sounds like an early draft of the 12 traditions here.
You know, that's a good news, because I've seen some unruly drunks show up at meetings, and you can be kicked out of a meeting, but you can't be kicked out of AA. So, that our leaders might serve but never govern, that each group was to be autonomous, and there was to be no professional class of therapy. There are to be no fees or dues. Our expenses were to be met by our own voluntary contributions. There was to be the least possible organization, even in our service centers.
Boy, isn't that the fact.
Our public relations were to be based upon attraction rather than promotion. It was decided that all members ought to be anonymous at the level of press, radio, TV, and films.
Let me bring out a couple of things in that one tradition right there. It says that I need to be anonymous at the level of press, radio, TV, and films. My name's Larry Scott, and I'm an alcoholic. My phone number is 678-300-2108. I don't need you looking for Larry S. when you come to Atlanta. You're not going to find me. My name's Larry Scott. We are not anonymous amongst ourselves. Our home group is We Are Not a Glum Lot Big Book Study on Thursday nights at Dunwoody Methodist Church, and twice a year we bring in key speakers from all over the place. And we print their name. Chris Raymer, Mickey Boudouin, Charlie Yao, Carl Morris. And it's okay with them. We're not anonymous amongst ourselves. But in the book here, it says, at the level of press, radio, TV, and films. If you look at today's version of that tradition, TV's not there. They thought TV was a passing fad. It wasn't going to make it. Mm-hmm. They dropped it.
Then it goes on to say, and in no circumstances should we give endorsements, make alliances, or enter public controversies. Bill Wilson broke every one of those traditions before he wrote them down. Their experience, and Bill was writing, he was a writing fool. When you give him a typewriter and enough time and some coffee, he'd be writing all kinds of stuff. And he would write things on AA letterhead and send out his opinions about other things outside of AA on AA letterhead. And they had to go, Bill, listen, I know this is like your baby. You can't do that. AA does not have an opinion. And on September 11, 2001, when those planes flew into the towers in New York City, they went to the General Service Office in New York, and they asked for AA's opinion. And we didn't have one, thank God. And then they found one of us outside to give an opinion, I'm sure. You know, what do you think? Damn them, you know. So this was the substance of AA's 12 traditions, which are stated in full on page 561 of this book. And the good news is that the long form came out first, which is great. Because anytime somebody comes in going, hey, you know, the only membership requirements is an honest desire. And I'm like, you should read the long form of the tradition. It should be the long, you know, those who are suffering from alcoholism. You know, and if you don't know what alcoholism is, there's a chapter called Doctor's Opinion that will help you diagnose it. So it says, though none of these principles had the force of rules or laws, they'd become so widely accepted by 1950, they were confirmed by the first international conference in Cleveland. Today, the remarkable unity of AA is one of the greatest assets of our society has. Now, while the internal difficulties of the adolescent period were being ironed out, public acceptance of AA grew by leaps and bounds.
You guys are going to want to highlight and underline all this information right here. This is powerful stuff.
Now, for this, there were two principal reasons. Number one, large number of recoveries. And number two, reunited homes.
We had a conversation about this out here on the deck this afternoon. We're talking 1955 here. The war has just ended, the second big WW. And AA, the public acceptance of AA was growing by leaps and bounds. And the reasons were is the large number of people getting sober. It was working. and reunited homes. Divorce was not even uttered in the households in 1955. You stayed no matter what. So families are getting back together. Families, not couples. And people are getting sober. So the public acceptance was enormous around our world.
It says that these made their impressions everywhere. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried.
There's your key.
50% got sober at once and remained that way.
So one out of two that came in and really wanted this thing and they really did the work, 50% success rate. Hmm. What else?
25% sobered up after some relapses. And among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Other thousands came to a few AA meetings and at first decided they didn't want the program. But great numbers of these, about two out of three, began to return as time passed.
If you go and look at the book, Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age, this equation is broken down. And in 1955, Alcoholics Anonymous had a 75% success rate. It's not my opinion. It's printed in our literature. You know, we pulled up today, and Christian saw you. Says, "I'll be damn, there's Colonel Sanders."
I did not.
He didn't. But if you really try, your chances today are no different than they were back then. And I'm gonna. This is my opinion. Okay, my opinion is since the influx of treatment centers and psychobabble, our success rate has died down. When AA first started. This is fact. There was speaker meetings, and there were literature meetings. Treatment centers came on the scene, and all of a sudden they had these group participation meetings. Success rate took a dive, and then you got the influx of the other issues. But the point I make is, you guys paid money to come here this weekend and hear something out of this book, and I love what my buddy Christian says. You're not here. And you're not going to get sober because of he and I. You never went to the bar and got drunk because of the bartender. You went to the bar because of what he was pouring. And my prayer is that we pour the truth up here this weekend. Y'all take five and we're going to see what Dr. Silkworth's got to say.
Guys, a couple of things that I want to go over before we get started here.
Is your thing on? I don't think you're on.
I'm on.
Now you're on.
Bite me. Guys, a couple of things before we get going. I think it's real important that we say thank you to Frank and Chaz. Those guys have worked their butts off to get us all here. And as I mentioned, we get the honor and the privilege to do this stuff all over the country. And we thought that our hosts last weekend had outdone themselves. They cooked up three huge stock pots of low country boil. If you haven't had that, it's potatoes and corn and andouille sausage and shrimp. And we thought that was the deal. And then we get out here and Frank has run us all over y'all's area and just blown our minds and fed us incredible food. And God, what a great place. We were talking about group consciences a while ago, and Frank and I had one out here in the hallway a while ago where y'all were doing what y'all were doing. And if you would, leave your clocks the way they are until you get in your car to leave on Sunday. Otherwise, Christian and I might get stuck here with y'all for another week, and we don't want to do that. I got dogs and motorcycles and women I got to go see. Lastly, I'm going to give you a promise. And this is from my heart to you, and I mean this with every fiber of my being. If you make the notes in this book, and you hear the truth, and you educate yourself, and you arm yourself with this information about yourself and about your disease, the only reason you'll ever drink again is because you want to. I mean that with everything in me. The only reason that you'll ever drink again is because you want to.
There's a caveat. you have to do the work. The information that we transmit that is in this book is great, but it won't change who you are unless you actually apply it in your life and do it and invite a God of your understanding in to help you.
Well, when I said arm yourself with the information, you can't arm yourself until you do the work.
Yeah.
You can read it all damn day. Let's go.
Doctor's opinion. Dr. William Duncan Silkworth lost a shirt in 1929 in the New York stock market crash. He went to work at Towns Hospital. And a little bit about Towns Hospital. It was the predecessor of the Betty Ford. It was a high-end drying-out joint. That's all it was. I mean, we sugarcoat it. He did a lot of work at Bellevue as a neurologist, but he really took on a job that was a little bit beneath him, and he studied his choice. He studied alcoholics. He was there to flush them with all kinds of laxatives and vitamins and hydrotherapy and electroshock, and they were doing all kinds of stuff trying to help alcoholics, but he decided to study them because he noticed that they were showing back up 6 weeks later. And then another 6 weeks later. And it was a revolving door of these well-to-do New York socialites coming in and leaving, coming in and leaving. And he couldn't understand because, see, every other disease could be treated. But alcoholism just befuddled him. And I'll give you a couple real quick dates. These won't do anything except kind of show you a progression. In 1784, Dr. Benjamin Rush, his signature appears on a Declaration of Independence. He described alcoholic addiction as a disease. In 1849, a Dr. Magnum Huss, a Swedish physician, was the first to use the term alcoholism.
Keeping in mind now, the AMA has not accepted alcoholism as a disease. This man was the first one to call it a disease. Huge difference.
Well, he just coined the term alcoholism. In 1951, American Public Health Association described alcoholism as an illness. And in 1957, the AMA finally declared alcoholism as a highly complex illness.
And Blue Cross and Blue Shield decided they'd pay for it if you wanted to go to 28 days.
Mm-hmm. It used to be a lot more, and then they finally got smart and cut back. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book.
Once again, any time that they use the word we or us in this book, they're talking about the first 100. And the reason this is in here, this is an unbiased opinion. It's like if I were going to go out and sell a manual on punching out a big twin Harley, nobody's going to buy it because I'm just a run-of-the-mill knucklehead that loves to ride. But if I get signed up with somebody that's maybe from the race team at Harley-Davidson Factory, and they co-author this thing, and they tag it, the chances of that book selling big time is a lot higher. So when Alcoholics Anonymous decided to sell this book, they're going to put Dr. Silkworth in there because, after all, he's hooked up with us.
Yeah. And this is really, this letter is in here for no other reason than to get lend credibility to us as a fellowship.
Yep.
This first letter that he wrote does nothing to describe what we have or how to help another alcoholic. He wasn't writing for us. He was writing to represent us, to make us look good. So as his convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. Well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction gave AA this letter. To whom it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. Late 34, I attended a patient, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless.
Bill Wilson, and you want to highlight, underline that word hopeless. That means he's going to die.
Back off the table. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery.
During his third treatment, he had learned from Ebbie Thatcher about the practical program of action and the spiritual solution from the Oxford Group.
As part of his rehab, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered.
There's that silly word again, if you'd like to highlight it.
He says, I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance. Because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group, they may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism.
Annals or historical record.
These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves.
Anything they say about themselves. If I come up to you and I start talking to you about Turk, listen up, because he's a dog. No, if I come up and I start talking to you about another alcoholic, take it with a grain of salt. I just met this man yesterday. I have no idea. I love him, but I don't know much about him. But if I start talking to you about me and my disease and my solution, my experience, listen up, because you can rely absolutely on what I tell you. Because when I'm talking to you, I'm talking about your life.
Very truly yours, William D. Silkworth, M.D.
In the original book, he didn't sign that book. You're welcome to come by and visit this one. This is on that page. It says, very truly yours, signed, ... M.D. This was a theory. He wasn't sure it was going to pan out. But he gave him the letter. And then he hung around for a minute, and what happened?
You got the reading?
It says, the physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. That's that second letter. In his statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind.
Talking about the allergy and the obsession.
Now, it didn't satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent, with some of us. But we're sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete.
Once again, the physical factor, the allergy of the body, is the component of this disease that sets me apart from a hard drinker, normal drinker, problem drinker, or the notorious social drinker. Alcoholism has been around since recorded history. I've got a document in my hand that came from the other big book. And I want to read it to you. If you want to write this down, you might want to go to Proverbs 23. And here's what that book says. It says, who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has strife? Who has complaints? Who has needless bruises? Who has bloodshot eyes? Those who linger over wine, who go to sample bowls of red wine, do not gaze at wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a snake and poisons like a viper. Your eyes will see strange sights, and your mind imagine confusing things. You're like the one sleeping on the high seas, lying on top of the rigging up on the mast. They hit me, you will say, but I'm not hurt. They beat me, but I don't feel it. When will I wake up so I can find another drink? Kind of sounds like an alcoholic, doesn't it? That's Proverbs.
There's a version of that floating around. We look every time we go to a new location, try to find some new version, and there's like the Jerry Falwell or something version of the and it says like your eyes will behold strange women.
Amen.
And it's like, you know, can hook up.
Still do.
I know.
You go to enough A&A meetings, you can see some of them.
All right. We're gonna skip over to the top of the next page. Says the doctor writes, the subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction.
There's a lot going on in that little sentence. It says the subject presented. The subject presented is the precise method of recovery. And then he uses a very strong word, paramount importance.
The book says, I say this after many years' experience as medical director in one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was therefore a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well-equipped to apply the powers of good.
Yeah, they were ultra-modern standards. Let's talk about that a second. Hydrotherapy. Shock therapy. Hydrotherapy. Envision in your mind's eye a large room, tiled walls, tiled floor, tiled ceiling. Alternating hot and cold shower heads. They'd take a vibrating drunk and strap him down on a gurney, crank him shower heads up, and run him down through there. Hot, cold, hot, cold, hot, cold, hot, cold. At the end of the run, they had a real clean drunk. Didn't do a thing for his alcoholism, but he was clean. You know, Clancy, I've never done this at this stage, but Clancy did a talk one time, and he was talking about something they tried at all these different spin dries, and they had a bar set up in one of these spin dries. They had a bartender. They had all the liquor that you could want right there, all that rock and rye and red liquor. They had Crown Royal and scotch and you name it. And these patients in the day room, and they're shuffling around. You know how they shuffle in that detox medication? But you could belly up to the bar and order a drink. The only difference was they had a wire attached to the bottom of the glass. And you belly up and say, I think I'll have a scotch on the rocks. You'd say, coming right up, dude. You pick it up and you look at it and go, wonder what that wire's for. Turn it up and it went down smooth and say, that went pretty good. I have another one the same. You turn it up and you hit that button under the bar and you go, bam, and knock the hell out of you. And I thought, you know, a little shock to the face might get you to quit. That's what I'm thinking. Christian mentioned weak-willed people earlier. We're not weak-willed people. We live in the South, and in July, August, it gets to be over 100 degrees. You come up out of that place, wherever it is you're working, and you got to have a drink. Not that you want one, you got to have one. Y'all know what I'm talking about? So you ease your way out to that old beat-up car in the parking lot, and you got a pint of vodka up under the seat, probably something real high-end like that Red Label Smirnoff or something. And you reach up under that bottle sitting there about 130 degrees, and you spin the lid off of it, and you pour it down, and it gets right about here, and you go... and it gets that yo-yo thing going. And you finally go... and you get it down. That is not a weak-willed person. See what I'm talking about? Ultra-modern standards and scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well-equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. Synthetic knowledge is what they've learned in books. They're not alcoholics. You are equipped to do more good than any doctor on the planet unless he's a recovered alcoholic. Because you got something that they ain't got. Go ahead.
Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here, he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving, we consented. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and warily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves, and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor. This often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve.
What he says here, the word phenomena is like miracle. It's something that can't be explained. This is the manifestation of an allergy. We have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. You know, an abnormal reaction, an allergy. I dated a girl, I was engaged to her. She had an allergy to gluten, to wheat. And when we could go to a restaurant and they could put croutons on her salad, and I'd say, honey, let me send that back. She said, no, it's okay. Let me just pick them off. And she'd pick them croutons off that salad, but one of them little crumbs would get down in that lettuce somewhere. And she'd put it in her body, and she'd break out in these great big welts all over her body. There's a doctor in our home group, and he's allergic to shellfish. God bless him. Can't imagine life without shellfish. But anyway, he's allergic to them. When he eats it, his throat closes up. He has an abnormal reaction. Penicillin, same thing. This manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving, because once you start, you can't stop. You've heard that one, one is too many and a thousand ain't enough. That's what they're talking about here. Alcohol affects normal people differently. I was out with a girl from Chile a couple of weeks ago, Elisa. And she says, do you mind if I have a glass of wine with dinner? I said, no, it's cool. She said, you sure? My first date, I took her to a speaker meeting. She's never been to an AA meeting. Pretty weird. Never know. You might get lucky. Feel sorry for me. Anyway. Yeah, exactly. So she orders this glass of wine. It comes. She sips it. The salad came. She sipped it. The appetizer came. She sipped it. Dinner came. She sipped it. I'm watching this glass of wine. Y'all know you know I've got my eye on it. Well, I got a qualifier. So dessert came. She says, I think I'd like a coffee. Check came. Half a glass of wine on the table. I said, honey, excuse me. Are you going to finish that glass of wine? Oh, no. I'm beginning to feel it. I wanted to slap her. What's the point? And you meet these people and you say, aren't you going to finish that? Oh, no, I'm beginning to feel a little loose, or I'm beginning to feel woozy. Push through that. You know, just push on through that. It affects them differently.
Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices.
Frothy emotional appeal. If you don't stop, I'm going to leave you. I'm taking the kids and the dog. If you don't stop, we're going to fire you. If I catch you drinking and driving again, you're going to jail. That's frothy emotional appeal. We don't tap the brake at a warning. Hard drinker, normal drinker, problem drinker goes to court. Judge says, Mr. Smith, if I see you in my court again driving an automobile while drinking, you're going to county for 90 days. Hard drinker quits drinking while driving. I go to court. Judge says, Mr. Scott, if I see you in my court again while drinking while operating a motor vehicle, you're going to county for 90 days. I start wondering what it's going to be like in jail, because I'm going. I'm going.
The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight.
When Bill Wilson was sitting in his house in his kitchen drinking and Ebbie Thatcher showed up, Bill didn't have to ask Ebbie, how do you know about the drinking game? Are you an alcoholic? He knew he was. They'd run together. He knew that Ebbie Thatcher, once he got started drinking, he couldn't stop. So when Ebbie sat down and told him about his practical program of action, and the solution that he'd found in the Oxford group, he had no choice but to listen, and it held his interest.
Skip down to the next paragraph. Silkworth writes that if any feel that as a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us a while on the firing line. See the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments. And the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. A little bit about Silkworth and the time when this was written. There was a social hierarchy, and doctors could fix anything. Well, that's what they would tell you. They could fix it all. There wasn't anything that could get by them. And Silkworth threw up his hands in complete failure and said, I have no idea how to help you. No idea. And that's very debilitating for a doctor, because they were up there, man. They were miracle workers, or at least they professed to be. It was a very ego-driven profession, especially in that day and age.
God complex.
I mean, yeah, I got it. I can fix you. And they couldn't fix it. How many people here have stood at a pulpit overlooking a dead body in a casket and had to stare the parents of this poor bastard who died from alcoholism and stare in their face and say, I don't understand why he didn't do what we do to get and stay sober. I wish I could bring help and closure to that pain, that confusion, that frustration. Especially when his brother's sitting in the front row, sober.
Still sober.
But, you know, Larry and I both speak at the same funeral. A guy that we knew, loved to death, man, great guy, died from alcoholism. And he's laying in that coffin. It's just like Silkworth. You stand on the firing line. You watch the death, watch the despairing wives, the children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of your everything that is your fiber is watching people die around you and you can't fix them. You know? And how many people have ever tried the sponsorship carrying an alcoholic? It sucks. You can carry the message. You can't carry the alcoholic. You know, and I'm so grateful that somebody along the line took me to that part in the 12th step. It says, Christian, you carry the message. You don't deliver it. Domino's delivers. We carry this message. If they want it, great. Come on, man. We got a fellowship. It's a wonderful thing to feel a part. I've heard more laughter in this room just in the last 20 minutes than I had in the last week. There's more camaraderie, love, fellowship. This is thicker than blood, man. This is a fellowship of spirit. And I know y'all look out for one another. You know, this is a nodding heads going on in here. That's what Silkworth's talking about, man. We have encouraged this movement because it works. People are staying alive, and they're not just staying sober. They're enjoying sobriety. You know, there's people walking through infernos in this room, and y'all are walking through them with grace and dignity and sharing that hope with the new guy coming along. That's a big deal, man. Because if this was just about not drinking, would we be in the woods laughing and cutting up and studying a book? I don't think so.
Have you ever just not drank? How you doing? Fine.
Speaking of drinking, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol.
Okay. Hmm. People will tell you, I love a good single malt scotch. Love that taste. I love a good 1968 Bordeaux. I never drank. If it didn't have a screw cap, I didn't trust it much. You know what I'm saying? People, it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect that alcohol brings. As you sit here this weekend, normally we don't have great water like this. They have to bring it in bottles. And I'll drink somewhere up to about 48 bottles of this stuff this weekend. And you'll see me go through a number of these pitchers this weekend. And the reason being is I have a pretty severe case of dry mouth, and I love good spring water. These guys have been telling me about y'all's water for a month. And I didn't believe it could be that good. And I really mean that. But you can rest assured of one thing. When I go up to the room tonight, I'm not going to carry two or three of these pitchers up there and gorge myself on water tonight. When I get up in this table, that'll be all the water I drink. There's a restaurant in Atlanta It used to be called Po'Folks. It's a country, it's a southern cooking restaurant. And it's changed its name to Folks. In the early days, they prided themselves in their southern fried chicken and good southern, strong, sweet iced tea. And you could go in there and you could buy this sweet iced tea by the gallon and take it with you. And I was raised by a good southern woman that loved to make good, strong, sweet iced tea. So I love going to Po'Folks and eating and drinking that iced tea and eating that fried chicken. But never have I gone to Po'Folks at 7 o'clock in the morning where they got the back door propped open with the bread crates and they got that pine saw and bleach running out and they're in there prepping for the day's lunch. Never have I gone up there at 7 o'clock in the morning and went, "Hey, could I come in and have a glass of that good sweet iced tea? Go in and take a chair off of the table and sit down and drink sweet iced tea until they run my tail out of there at 10 o'clock at night." Never done that. But boy, there's been them other places where they said, "You got to go. You can't stay here." And I camped out in the parking lot. How many of y'all remember your first drink? Show of hands. Come on. First drink. All right. How many of y'all remember your first Pepsi Cola? Got it. Point made. I like what alcohol does for me.
I worked in the restaurant industry for 14 years, and I'll get waiters and bartenders come up and ask me to sponsor them. And I said, "Tell me if you can finish this sentence. Last call." And then it would, "For alcohol." And I was like, "Yeah." One of them came up, and I had the best one I've ever heard, which is, "If you don't work here, and if you ain't sleeping with somebody who works here, you got to go." You know, and it's like, because that's a bartender always told me that it was the most disturbing thought that you ever heard, which is, "You ain't got to go home, but you can't stay here." I was like, "Damn, man, if I need to stay here." Why? Because the sensation is so elusive that while I may admit it is injurious, I cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. What is the sensation? Something happened between the bottom of the second beer and the beginning of the middle of the third. Something happened. And it was pretty consistent, something that happens to most alcoholics. You know, I drank because of what alcohol did for me. You know, my shoulders broadened. I grew about 9 inches. My voice deepened, became extraordinarily intelligent, witty, and charming. The women wanted to be with me, and the men wanted to be me.
He's delusional.
I know. That's an entire psychic change. I had a perception that my life changed, all because of the end of the second beer and the middle of the third. But somehow I always ended up around a toilet puking my brains out because I drank 15. Or I wound up on the front porch of somebody's house, and we became intimately acquainted with one another the next morning when they asked the question, "What the hell are you doing on my front porch?" And you don't have a good answer for that one. You know, I mean, there's just so many things. How come I couldn't stay in magic time? Something between the middle of the second beer and the middle of the third beer. Something happened. Everything fit. That breath that I'd been seeking all my life. You know, that, wow, man. Woo. And there's a part in Bill's story. We're going to kind of touch on it. There's a part in Bill's story where he is invited to a party because he's about to go make the world safe for democracy. And Bill goes from being introduced to having people introduced to him. And in that day and age, when you were introduced to somebody, you were being elevated up to their level. And Bill knew that. He was lower than anything. He knew he wasn't cut up for anything good. But to be introduced to somebody was showing the person you were being introduced to respect. Bill, after a few Bronx cocktails, went from being introduced to having people introduced to him. "Yes, right. I'm Bill Will. Oh, I was so glad to meet you." You know, something happened that went through all that. To us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. We are restless, irritable, discontented. Unless we can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks, which I see other people taking with impunity.
So it says that we drink because we're restless, irritable, and discontented. And then it says we don't drink, or when we do drink, we get this sense of ease and comfort. And what we will what will develop for you, hopefully, over the course of this work, you develop a sense of ease and comfort without the alcohol. And it comes from this vital spiritual experience.
You know, drinking alcohol is an artificial means to a spiritual experience. Working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a practical means to a spiritual experience. You hear people talk about it. Alcohol did for me quickly, but AA does for me slowly over a period of time. I build up a level of ease and comfort, and guess what? I'm rendered unthirsty. And when people are rendered unthirsty, they don't need a drink. You know, you ever seen anybody wearing I've worn one. You ever seen anybody wearing a straitjacket? It's a really neat thing to see because they look crazy. It sucks. You're in there. You ain't getting out of there. And I didn't have any Harry Houdini tricks up my sleeve. And when you're in there, you look nuts. You ever seen anybody full-time not drinking? That's a tough spot to be because you want to almost suggest to them, you need a drink because you're starting to piss us off, man. You really need something to calm down. The book suggests once, after they have succumbed to the desire again,
that's
so
the allergy.
Many do.
That's the allergy.
And the phenomenon of craving develops, we pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over and over and over. And real quick, show of hands. How many people tried to quit and drink more than once? All right, my people. Over and over again. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of their recovery. That's the bad news. Nail in the coffin. On the other hand, strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred in the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems they despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds themselves easily able to control their desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules.
And that's coming from the great William D. Silkworth.
We don't go over it in this particular book study, but we elaborate on it in the one we do back home. But I invite you to look at Triple X in the fourth edition on that page. They go over five different kinds of alcoholics, and I always like to point this out because it's such a perfect example. So many people paid it. I speak at DUI schools every now and then, and I'll ask the question, how many alcoholics? Every hand goes up, and I've said, why? And everybody's like, did you read the name of the building when you walked in? DUI school, you fool. And I'm thinking, well, see, I never got a DUI. DUIs don't make you alcoholic. They make you bad drivers when you're drunk. You got caught. I never got caught. What makes me alcoholic is what happens to me once I introduce alcohol. And that page, XXX, page Roman numeral 30 in the fourth edition, and I think it's one page prior to that in the third edition, talks about five different types of alcoholics. Regardless of which one you may find yourself fitting into, the most important thing to remember is this. If they bolted the doors and put bars over these windows and introduced 10 to 20 kegs of beer, 15 to 20 cases of good rye, you know, I'm pretty sure there's some vodka drinkers in here, and I think there's a couple wine heads. I was one of them. And we locked this building down for a month. You'd have a lot of interesting reactions going on. You'd have fighting and cussing and fussing. You'd have some laughing, and there might be some karaoke going on. There'd probably be some bonfire songs. There'd probably be a couple people hanging out in the corner drinking all by themselves. There definitely would be some fights and some philosophical conversations up here. You know, all kinds of different weird physical manifestations going on. But one thing would have us all united. Because it's too many times people will pay too much attention to what they did when they drank, not the effect alcohol had on them in here. The most important thing is that we're trying to scratch an itch we can't. The more we drink, the thirstier we get. The allergy is what sets us apart as a distinct entity. You know, because I've had so many people walk up going, well, I got into fights when I drank. I said, then stop fighting when you drink. Well, that makes me an alcoholic. No, it doesn't. Let's go back to what the book says. If we don't have that phenomenon of craving, you're not alcoholic, you know? And it's such an important thing because there's hard drinkers who come in AA all the time and want to take exception to, why do you got to push these books? Why do you got to push these steps? Why do you got to keep talking about God? Man, because if you don't have this disease, you don't need any of that. And we're not here for the hard drinker. We're here for the person who's going to die
the
from
fellowship,
alcoholism.
Our fellowship, our meetings are infiltrated and jam-packed with hard drinkers. There's some in this room tonight. Cool. We got some great coffee. The food is off the chain.
Mm-hmm.
Some good people. Warm fire. Welcome. But if you're alcoholic, you get what we're talking about from up here. Alcoholic, man, they ain't no question about it. And guys, there's going to be something, and I'm not going to give it away. I mean, even our hosts don't even know this because we're going to spring it on them at the same time we're going to spring it on you. But there's going to be a magic that happens in this room tomorrow. I promise you, because it never fails. I want to give it away so bad I can't stand it. And it's not anything we do. It's something that's going to happen out here tomorrow. And I know some of you guys are probably going to want to walk and talk and hear Fifth Step. But the ones that come back here tomorrow, bring your seat belts because you're going to get rocketed. We're going to be back in here in the morning at 8. We actually ended a little early tonight. And tomorrow we may get into some of that free time that this schedule says. But we're going to get through this tomorrow. Thank you guys for being here tonight. Amen. It's been a kick. Okay. I tell you what, y'all may not know how to do a lot of things, but you know how to eat around here.
Amen.
Y'all are going to roll me up on the plane, and they'll come pick me up at the airport and say, Larry's comatose. What
he's
happened?
Smiling.
He was taking fat on a trip to Eugene, Oregon. Is this sounding okay? Am I echoing?
What?
I'm echoing. You got me over there, Kern? I'm echoing. He's working on it.
You're doing good.
All right. Couple of things that I'd like to share with you this morning is we've looked at this schedule and there's an outside chance that we're going to get into this 3 to 5:15 this afternoon. That free time they've got for you here at this break. And if we do, up front, you got my amends, but y'all brought us out here to do a job and I'm just not sure that we're going to be able to do it in the time allotted. We're going to do our level best. Let's start this thing out this morning with a moment of silent meditation followed by our serenity prayer. And in this moment of silence, let's think about why we're here. Serenity prayer.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, Lord, and the wisdom to know the difference.
My name is Larry Scott, and I am an alcoholic.
Larry.
And I'm free this morning. Sobriety date is December 31st, 1987. I tell you that because my sponsor told me I needed to tell you, so you'd know I got one. And I do. I wish I had time to tell you about that old sponsor of mine. He is a road dog, and he beats me into a state of reasonableness on a daily basis. Most loving man I've ever known. Last night, we ended up talking to you about Dr. Silkworth and his opinion. If you gentlemen were medical students, and you were in a teaching hospital or a university, and you were in one of those amphitheater rooms, and they were teaching you about, say, tonsillitis, they would take you through the printed literature and you would take all these little mini exams and they'd talk to you about how tonsillitis is manifested in the human body, how the human body responds to an infection of that sort. And then what they'd do is they'd put a white lab jacket on you, they'd hang a stethoscope around your neck and they'd march you down the hall of that teaching hospital to a room or a ward where there was a patient suffering from tonsillitis. And it'll let you get a firsthand look at how that disease is manifested in that human's body. You'd look at the chart and see the elevated temperature and first one thing and another. And so what we're going to do today is we're going to introduce you to a man that has alcoholism so that you can see how this disease, the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body is manifested in this man's life, in his marriage, in his friendships, in his career, and how it progresses throughout his life. And we're going to do that by reading about one of my favorite people ever, and his name is William Wilson. And I love this guy. I wish to God I'd have known him. He loved to run.
Good morning. My name is Christian Proctor. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 7, 2001. William Griffith Wilson. He looks pretty benign, doesn't he? Well, he didn't start out looking like that. He started out looking like that. And you can tell by that grin on his face that he's up to something. Says, war fever ran high in that New England town to which we new young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned. And we were flattered when the first citizens took us to their homes, making us feel heroic.
This New England town was East Dorset, Vermont.
Bill Wilson was had the opportunity to advance a little bit in his school, and he was actually in a military academy, and he was going to be an officer when he went into the World War. It says, here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor.
Kind of briefly, Bill Wilson was thrown away by his father. His father left the family at a very young age. He was alcoholic. Alcoholism was real prevalent on the Wilson side of the family. And Bill was warned all his life about they had a bug. That when the men in this family started drinking, they couldn't quit. And when I tell you he was thrown away, the old man left. And then shortly after he left, Mama left. Mama left to go to medical school to learn homeopathy. And so the mother and father left Bill and his sister to stay with her parents. And Bill didn't measure up. Everybody else had parents, but Bill and Dorothy didn't. And all of a sudden, Bill became an overachiever. He had to be first and best at everything he did to prove to the world that he measured up. And right here, we're going to start that out by saying, I was part of life at last. Somebody wanted me. Somebody recognized me for who and what I am. And then there's an alcoholic statement here. Most people have their first drink. Bill Wilson discovered liquor. Mm. Pretty alcoholic.
He says, I forgot the strong warnings and the prejudices of my people concerning drink. In time we sailed for over there. I was very lonely and I again turned to alcohol. We landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside.
Right here, Bill, we're going to follow Bill's progression of his alcoholism. He says, I was very lonely. That's a pretty good reason to drink. And he says, and again turned to alcohol. And this thing's just going to continue to progress. And there's a statement here. He says, much moved at Winchester Cathedral. He wandered outside. Later in this book study, he's going to mention it three times. And when we get to the third part, we're going to pull out a book, and we're going to tell you what happened to Bill that day. Something monumental happened to Bill Wilson inside Winchester Cathedral that day.
I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot whether he dieth by musket or by pot.
The gravesite of Thomas Thatcher, no relation to Ebbie Thatcher.
Ominous warning which I failed to heed.
Ominous is threatening.
Now a little bit of history. When Bill went to Burton and Burr Military Academy, he was going to be commissioned as an officer. He got an option. You know, where do you want to serve? In what capacity? I'll be the Marine Battalion on the coast. He says, 22 and a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. Bill could hear the explosions, but he couldn't see anything.
They never got into France. They were held up in England, and the war was going on in France. And he could hear them faintly, but the explosions in his mind and the gunfire in his mind.